Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is presented by Shaxbury Cider.
Hey, this is Hannah Forden. I'm the program manager here at Heritage Radio Network. This year, we're celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary, and I want to thank all of our listeners and members for being a part of an incredible year of food radio. We never would have made it this far without all of you. So HRN is now in its summer fun drive, and this is when we turn to you and ask that you make a donation to help ensure a bright future for food radio. Whether you listen to one show or 20, there's a reason why you keep tuning in week after week. All of our content is powered by a small nonprofit, and we rely on your generosity to keep going. Help us keep broadcasting the most thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational conversations happening in the world of food and beverage. So become a member today. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have some brand new member gifts available online, so I encourage you to snag your new favorite pizza-themed t-shirt or enamel pin today and show the world how much you love HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate so you can snag your 10th anniversary member swag. And thank you.
Good morning. Today is Thursday, July 11th. This is the Main Course OG. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here in studio with my co-host, Patrick Martins.
I missed last week, and I heard the ratings were higher without me here, which really, I want to discuss this after the show.
You know, we're thinking of moving you to part-time. You can be, you can take sabbatical more often if you'd like.
It's bring your daughter to work day. I don't know if you noticed this.
It is. In fact, I was going to introduce one of our co-hosts here, Charlotte.
Are you going to say hello? No? Okay. She's denying us any access to her brilliant brain.
All right. Well, we have Brandon Hoy here in the studio along with his daughter, Charlotte. And we have Eric Koss of the Alameda Sun on the line. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Hi, guys.
Thanks for joining us. I know Patrick was out there in California with you last week.
I was just saying, we saw each other physically for the first time, and I think I can honestly say we were both a little disappointed.
Did you confirm what Brandon thought, that he doesn't usually have pants on?
No, you had pants.
He did not have pants on.
No, you had
you had shorts on.
Yeah, I had shorts on. But it was nice. We went to a pool party in Alameda, and it was a communal pool. That looked to have a low urine count by the color of it. I mean, there were like 700 kids in there, but it didn't look to be more than 2 or 3% urine. But anyway, it was lovely. And our friend Brian Kenny, who I'd like to be the first to announce, is going to be on the board once we get Brandon's I vote. Brian Kenny.
Doesn't that count?
There's plenty
of witnesses to this vote, right?
If you mean listeners, no. If you mean number of people in this room, then yes.
Awesome. Well, I think you're going to get two. Can our guests today, you know, also give an aye? No, they don't get to vote for the board.
I don't think they get a vote for the board, but they can say aye if they would like to.
All right, I see.
Our
guest for the weekly grill is Jeremy Price, executive chef of Ciccone's Dumbo here in Brooklyn. Good morning, chef.
Good morning.
Beautiful.
Thanks for
restaurant.
Being with us. It's beautiful on the waterfront in Dumbo. Yes. We're going to talk more about outdoor dining later. We also have Sonia Komisky in the studio with us. She's an Australian beef brand owner who specializes in an authentic French heritage beef program.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you.
Is that the only spot in the world that is both a country and a continent?
An island and a continent, yeah.
And a country?
Yeah.
So it's all three?
Yes.
I never knew that about Australia.
Oh, there's so much to learn.
New Zealand also a country and an island and a continent? I guess it's not a continent.
No.
Wow, that's impressive.
Australia wins.
Got a lot going on.
Good job,
also,
Australia.
Also, backwards swirling flush.
Oh, I brought that up earlier. Man, we think the same.
I know.
Well, are you disappointed?
Hey, can I just ask, real quick, Sonia, are you related to the Comiskey family that is famous for Comiskey Park, the White Sox, the Chicago White Sox?
I would like to lay claim to that, but unfortunately not, no.
Are they Australian, Eric?
No, but, you know, families...
Things happen.
Interestingly, it's actually an Irish name, and I know there's plenty of Irish immigrants founded the U.S. here.
No, for sure. Ireland's all over the place. No Irish allowed. That was like a famous sign throughout the early like 19th century. Like people didn't want them, and now they're everywhere.
You took yours down off the door of the studio today, right?
Yeah. Just no, I love Irish people. My name is Patrick.
All right. We are going to jump into our segment, The Weekly Based. This is our round robin question. What do you eat for breakfast? Go. Chef? Jeremy?
I'm really bad about eating breakfast. I usually do... Up until recently, a coffee and a cigarette, but now it's just coffee.
What, New York? So you're a recent transplant from LA. Yeah. You've come to New York. New York has made you quit cigarettes. Now it's just a coffee?
Yeah, now it's just coffee. And then, you know, getting to the restaurant and the small tasting of sauce and all that really sustains me throughout the day. Not good for the cholesterol.
It's funny. It's funny the opposite, like coming from LA to New York and quitting smoking.
It just always works the other way.
You're like in New York and all you do is drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. And then you go to LA and you're like, wow, I can breathe. It's great. I get up in the morning. Let's quit smoking. Let's do some healthy things. But coming to New York and doing healthy things just seems counterintuitive to me.
Now, is it true that the in the smoker lingo, like smoker to smoker, the first cigarette in the morning is called a shitterette? Is that true?
I don't know if I've ever referred to it as that, but yeah, I mean, a coffee and a cigarette will definitely get you going in the morning.
All right, Australia, what do you do for breakfast? Or is your breakfast dinner? No, that stays the same order, right?
I actually bought you guys a present.
Your
gift. I would normally have Vegemite on toast for breakfast.
Oh, my God. Can we play that song? Is that public access yet? Toto's song about Vegemite and all that?
I don't think that's Toto. I think that might be Flock of Seagull. No, it's not even Flock. It's a Minute Work. Thank you.
Okay, I did not.
Can I just eat this like
SL? Sadly, we are not a TV show here, so you guys can't see. This is a tube of Vegemite. Yeah,
it looks like toothpaste.
And I'd like to point out that if you actually try and carry this on an aircraft, it will get confiscated because it's considered a lotion.
Well, it's more than 3 ounces.
How does it moisturize?
Oh, gotcha. Right.
So you need to put your Vegemite in your checked bag.
I've heard it's good on toast, right?
There are quite good a few Australian restaurants here in New York, or sort of Australian.
Strong, huh?
It's a little fishy, right?
Whoa. Strong.
You spread it thin.
Woo.
My lord.
That is like, tastes like anchovy paste or,
Proudly made in Australia since 1923, Vegemite B vitamins for vitality. It really does look like it should be sunscreen or body lotion.
My daughter's very excited. She wants to try this new toothpaste.
I couldn't speak to the health values of it, but let's say it's got cultural heritage value.
Yeah, of course.
It stays with you, too. Like, this whole cup of coffee will not get rid of that.
But I see why you have it in the morning. It says it's essential for brain function, supports your nervous system, essential for energy release, and helps fight fatigue. Perfect with a coffee.
Yeah, no, I mean, that'll wake you up. Wow, that's a strong, like, anchovy, like, bottom of the sea kind of taste. But it's vegetables. Wow, it's interesting.
So I've been enjoying a bagel with a smear of cream cheese here in New York, which has been really nice.
With Vegemite on top?
No, the Vegemite is parked up for now.
We ask that question all the time on air. What is your favorite bite? Or if you were Meghan Markle's, you know, advisor, or what was one dish you would make to feed all the English people to be liked by them more? And one of my answers is always the bagel with cream cheese and onion and caper and all that lemon.
Oh, yeah, with the smoked salmon.
The wild salmon when it's wild.
Yeah.
I'm oatmeal now. I try to eat like one or two heaping portions of oatmeal each morning.
Do you put anything on it? Berries?
No,
sugar,
it's the only healthy thing I do is basically I eat oatmeal in
the
morning.
But that sounds like you're not enjoying
it.
No,
I'm not.
You don't top it with anything to make
maple
it.
Maple syrup.
You can put some Vegemite on there.
Oh, yeah, Vegemite.
I'm just a fruit in the morning. That's usually all I can do. An apple.
Yeah.
Coffee.
Fruit is a good start, for sure. Yeah. It eases you into it. Do you guys know Pete's Coffee at all?
Yes, but I drink it every morning. It's what we brew at home.
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
I just went by a Pete's Coffee. That's what I had for breakfast.
I tend to only eat breakfast on the weekends. It's something I like, a whole little process that we enjoy at home, and I sort of skip it during the week, which is, I know, not healthy. They say that breakfast is the most important.
I'm the same. I eat huge breakfast on Saturday and Sunday, but the rest of the week it's like just a piece of fruit, maybe a yogurt or something like that, but it's usually quick.
Charlotte, what do you have for breakfast?
Yep.
She almost always has a waffle.
Next question. Biggie versus Tupac, Jay-Z versus Dr. Dre. What's the biggest East Coast, West Coast rivalry in food? Jeremy, Chef Jeremy, you're from the West Coast. Brandon, you're from the West Coast. Eric is from the West Coast. Only Emily and I are representing. Am I saying that correctly? The East Coast?
I think you got that right. Repping. Yeah, representing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So nice. East Coast, West Coast. The East
and then we've got Sonia's from the far East Coast.
No, we would wonder if there's an East, West, or North, South there.
Eric is definitely more of a, he has a, you know, he's a little bit Tupac because he grew up on the East Coast and then he moved to the West Coast. But, you know, you could hear the East Coastness inside of him.
Did we pick the correct rappers for that? Biggie, Tupac, Jay-Z, Dr. Dre? No.
I would say that Biggie, Tupac would be just the one to convey the message here.
All right,
Everyone understands that.
My answer to this is the biggest rivalry is who is more local. The West Coast likes to think that everything is like local. You got to know your rancher. That's what their claim to fame. And they think that the East Coast doesn't know how to really do local because we are much more seasonal.
It's a lot harder in New York, right? Like you have seasons, you have shorter seasons in California. You can say, you know, this was grown in California. This was animal raised in California. California's a huge state. So in New York, I think it's a little more tricky to do.
Yeah, local. So what? Right. I'd still travel 3,800 miles down the coast of California. That is a funny thing you could say.
The farm's 6 hours away, but it's still technically local.
I mean, I think that New York was the epicenter of the sustainable, interesting, cutting-edge food movement. And then it got taken by Chez Panisse and Berkeley and the other. Now, I think because of Roberta's as a locale, plus the radio network, plus all the groups that kind of work near here or out of here or in Bushwick, I think this little area, this little zone, epicenter, terroir, has taken back the claim of most interesting food stuff in the world, or in America, is happening right here. So I think, you know, Roberta's helped take it back.
I couldn't comment on the East Coast, West Coast stuff because obviously I don't have that perspective, but I'm staying in Williamsburg and just going to the local grocery store, I've been really impressed at the amount of local provenance product, like product that's actually manufactured or value added here in Brooklyn. So I think you've certainly got something going on with local here in New York.
Also, the state of New York produces a lot of stuff. I think we forget that, you know, an hour and a half into Long Island, you're in farm country. Mm-hmm. An hour and a half upstate, you're into farm country. So also then all of the tri-state area, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. I mean, these are places that are lush with ag, like just going off. And there's a lot of stuff.
We can't sell them to D.C. because they all buy from the Shenandoah Valley. Yeah.
Totally.
The Appalachian Trail, that whole world.
The thing is just that we have seasons, unlike California, where they can produce their shoulder seasons are so long, they can produce so much, the volume of produce they can produce is massive because of the amount of time they get to grow. Here we have seasons, but also we get a lot more interesting things like the root, like different root vegetables, all these things that you don't get because it doesn't get cold there. We get those things as well.
And we're more challenged to be creative. I say, if you have a great terroir, then your tetoir of knowledge, of skills, of getting the most out of things isn't as tested or pushed or necessary. So when you come to Brooklyn, I think this is per capita or per inch, square inch, the highest tetoir.
The thing is, in Brooklyn, world, Patrick, the accessibility to anything is like in Brooklyn. There's places you could go. California and New York are not one of them. But try to like get food in Florida. It's incredibly difficult to get high quality product that that's not like locally grown there. It's hard to get that stuff. So even in Brooklyn, even if it, you could get like produce from Japan in Brooklyn, like
and it's fresh the day before.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I think California wins for tacos. We definitely win for bagels and pizza.
California definitely.
Yeah,
wins
yeah.
Oh, Jewish culture. That, yeah.
Yeah.
What were you gonna say, Eric?
Sort of. Oh, like the Mexican versus Italian kind of rivalry. I don't know. I think like, I don't know, California might think it has some pretty impressive Italian restaurants, but they're never gonna beat the East Coast on that, and vice versa with Mexican.
Agree.
I just have, yeah.
I mean, so, it's the first thing I do when I go home is Mexican, because it's just like, no matter, even though in New York they've got so much better, they're just like significantly better than when I moved here 20 years ago, but still, they don't even, it's not even close.
Do flour tacos anger you?
Flour tacos?
Like a flour tortilla.
Like a flour tortilla?
Yeah.
Versus corn?
Because they're inauthentic. Are they inauthentic?
I just get mad when I see them.
I mean, they have flour tortillas and Mexican cuisine.
It doesn't anger me. It's not like you just don't see it very often.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
it's flour,
for quesadilla, it's always corn, flour for quesadillas.
Yeah. Yeah.
It depends on where
you're or a burrito, you know, or, you know, I like to make an enchilada casserole with flour tortillas.
Hey. Yeah.
Jeremy, I mean, you're from New Mexico originally.
Like originally, yes. Which is
which has its own Mexican, form of Mexican as well, which is delicious. You know, if you haven't Christmas styled your anything, you're really missing out on life.
It's just Hatch chilies and copious amounts of cheddar cheese is really New Mexican cuisine. But there's nothing wrong with it. It's delicious.
The cheese is from Wisconsin. The chilies are from New Mexico.
Yeah.
That is funny. So speaking of, you know, local-ish, we received a press release about Azuluna, a healthy meal delivery service. It's based in Connecticut and run by a team of farmers, chefs, and nutritionists focused on serving ready-to-eat meals with all the ingredients being sourced from New England area farms. What do you guys think? Will the local focus in this case help them to do better than the rest of the, you know, meal delivery industry?
I think so. I think it's
a nice hook.
I think it's important, right? I mean, you're creating jobs, you're creating farms and more awareness in the community in which you're in, right? Which is like very important. I also think, you know, higher quality food, better nutrients. I think that, you know, that's better than getting something from some commodity farm that's put in an accessible manner so anybody can cook it. I think that.
Do you have mail delivery services, Sonia? Here in America, we've had ton that have opened and closed. Only very few have survived.
It's a recent phenomenon in Australia and growing. But Australia's quite a large country, so the logistics around getting...
It's a continent.
country/continent/island. It's like a model actor. So the logistics around transporting fresh food and cold chain logistics are quite challenging, but certainly something that's on the rise here with this company that you talked about. I'd be interested to see, you know, apart from just calling themselves local, what are they actually doing in terms of actions to set themselves apart from anyone else? Like, are they working with agritourism, for example, so that their clients can actually come and visit and connect and develop an emotional experience with producers? I'd be interested to see how their business model differs to a corporate.
That sounds like more transparency than a group like this may want. Because oftentimes, and you guys all know how I feel about this, oftentimes I think a lot of these things are just marketing ploys to like change, like to get somebody who would maybe go to Amazon to feel more comfortable about their decision and ordering food to their house.
Whether it's virtue signaling.
But honestly, like I'm usually pretty I don't usually believe these things to be true. I usually think that they're just like some sort of marketing.
We don't
scheme.
Really have agritourism here. That's something, I mean,
Italy. We're trying to start it at the Good Shepherd Conservancy. Frank Reese, our turkey farmer, was one of the first people that we always talked about. And it was mainly because of the popularity of visiting him with all the chefs. They just love seeing him. But I think that it would be interesting to me, and of course this will never happen, if these mail order companies are like ours. Like, we only send meat. So that's our specialty. And then some might only sell fish. And then I think it would be interesting to have vegetable companies that are like, we just have these fresh batch of bok choy that was grown in Eureka and Mendocino County. It's amazing. We have 5-pound bags. And then you buy that. But to think that some chef is going to make frozen a meal, you know, with all the different things, they're not going to be good at any of them. And it's going to be a commodity meat. It's going to be a farm-raised fish. It's going to be, you know, nothing will be special about
it. I mean, I think that's the only reason that a company like this might work, at least for a while, is because it is hyper-local. But what happens, you know, when the seasons change? And then can you only order root vegetable-based meals from this company in New England?
Cardoons for dinner again, honey.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
How do you think it... I mean, I think the biggest opportunity would be just to send out what's great right now, you know, like you were saying, like we got great apples this week, we got great artichokes this week, we whatever it may be,
and you get a pound of it.
Yeah. But does that sell to the mass consumer, or is that not their target? You know, it's like I come in and I say, chef, I trust you, cook me what's great, cook me what you got in today. And like for me, as someone who cares about enjoying an experience and quality ingredients, I love that. But some people are like, I only like these five things.
They don't know
how
to process a pound of vegetable. They're like, I only need 2 ounces. And you're like, you're supposed to eat it every day for the next 3 weeks. That's eating in season. You don't eat duck once in December. You might eat duck 4 or 5 times in November, December, January. Lamb, you should buy a half lamb and eat it over the course of 2 months. Vegetables too, but people don't think that. Like they'll buy a tomato just enough for the pasta. They should be buying 10-pound bags and freezing them and putting them up and keeping them all year. But
do you think that education aspect should be part of their shtick? Like it should be part of what they're delivering?
I think they have nothing to say. So it's just spin, you know, and it's just marketing. We actually have something to say. I mean, Eric and his thing, when he's selling his newspaper, he has something to say. Most places don't have anything to say, you know, they're not. They're
Sonia soulless. Sonia looks disappointed with that answer. I think she was hoping for a little bit more beacon
of hope.
No, these
big companies, this one I like. That's why we bring it up. I mean, a company like this has a mission. Most places don't have a mission.
But I think people are, with the meal service, are looking for convenience, right? Most of the time,
yeah, convenience.
They don't want to have to actually take it from a raw stage. So it'll be a little bit easier for them to feel better about it if they know that it's coming from New England and it's prepared by people who actually care about it, and there's some sustainability behind it rather than just Amazon sent me this box of food that
exactly
I'm gonna put in the microwave.
What were you going to say,
Eric?
In
terms of the learning part, I think it's like automatic is going to happen by osmosis, right? Because you might end up trying something in the kitchen that you hadn't before because you have these ingredients they sent to you and you didn't know what they were going to be. So you just end up learning something new about some new vegetable or something, and then it just happens kind of automatically. I think it's kind of a good thing. When I was in Italy a couple of years ago, we went to this one kind of farm-to-table thing. And everything on the table was, you know, sourced from within a mile of that table. It was pretty insane. And amazingly delicious and amazingly expensive. And, you know, people are making bucks off this kind of like local aspect. So I think they're going to do fine. I think it's a cool idea.
Well, let's start. This next question is interesting about education. You want to read it?
No, you go ahead.
Recently on America's Test Kitchen, someone was asked to describe the difference between two pieces of chocolate. The two pieces were exactly the same. The only difference was the style of music playing in the background as the tester ate the chocolate. So, you know, it was just interesting. It was the same chocolate, the music changes, and he's like, oh, this one is much richer. And so I was wondering, what percentage of people in the world do you think would actually get that right?
That it was the same piece of chocolate? The only difference was the music.
Exactly.
How many people would know it's the same? Don't that was a trick question. How many people in the world would be like, that was a trick question? Both those chocolates were the same. I heard you change the music in the back, but those chocolates are the same. And they're like, no, they're different. You're like, nope, they're the same. And then how many people would really back that up? People would make something up?
See, for me, it's like I would think, I'm sure I would get it wrong. I would think that they were different. Because also, once you have a piece of chocolate on your palate and then you're adding another one, do you rinse your mouth in between? I don't know. Like, maybe I'm overthinking it.
You would know.
Chef?
Well, I think you can, I mean, environment has so many different factors, right? How many times have you been to a restaurant and one experience was better than the other experience, and maybe that was because you liked the music a little bit more, right? I think,
or you liked your server better, or you were.
I don't know. I can't think of how many people would actually get that or not get that. It's.
Do you think a pastry chef would? Would they be like, it's the exact same piece of Ghirardelli chocolate?
Yeah, they'd be like, trick question. I can think. People would like, oh, can you taste Witch's Pepsi or Coke? Of course, they taste so different. You know what I mean? It's like, how did people really not know Tropicana versus whatever another big orange juice guy? They taste different. Everyone has their taste.
It's actually a really interesting area. There's been research done on this over in the UK at Oxford Uni where they did find that music does change people's perception of what they're tasting.
Oh, interesting.
And so with chocolate, for example, the soft, fluty kind of music led people to think they were eating something that was creamier and nicer, whereas using things like a staccato plucked violin tended to bring out the bitterness in taste. So it was really fascinating research. And I was at the American Meat Science Institute's conference in Colorado a couple of weeks ago, and Dr. Pradeep from Machine Vantage, who are a machine learning artificial intelligence organization, was speaking there, and he was saying that 95% of desires and decisions are non-conscious. So they happen inside your head. And music is one of the most significant contributors to our thought patterns there. So I totally think that people would get that wrong with the chocolate.
That's interesting. So I didn't think about it from the music.
All the people walking at home that were like, man, this guy's a dummy.
Did it?
Definitely not.
No, but I will say this. There was a famous test done throughout after World War II where everybody, there'd be like 30 people in the room, and everybody was in on the test except for one person. And they would ask outrageous things like, which line is longer? And all the 30 people in on the test would be like, this one is. And the person almost always was just like, yeah.
Like he went against something. Wanting to fit in.
Yeah. And I just think we live in a world that doesn't, even on the food level, doesn't want to say, that's not good. They want to say, and they will say, that's great. Even people who like you and want to help you, you're like your buddies from college, would be like, that was great. Even if you, by mistake, dumped a pound of salt in it, they would be like, no, it was pretty good. And it's not. You have to be honest. There is rights and wrongs when it comes to food. And I would absolutely want to think that I'd be that guy to be like, I don't know what you're saying. I think someone made a mistake back there because those were the same two chocolates. And they'd be like, no. And I'd be like, yes. You know, people don't think that way anymore.
Yeah, speaking of going to a restaurant and having different dining experiences, you know, it could be that the food didn't come out of the kitchen quite as good. And like, do you want to know that? Do chefs want to know?
I would.
I do, yeah. I mean, with the hours, the heat and all that, I mean, it's really the reason we do it is because we love doing it, right? And to be able to deliver that experience to somebody else. So if we're not delivering on that, I think it's really good to know.
Yeah. I love your restaurant. Just that one pasta was a little off. I mean, that's what you want to hear from people. That shows love.
No, it's true.
Constructive criticism.
More often than not, it's just something like, oh, maybe the cook needed a little bit more lemon juice to finish the pasta. Maybe it needed a little more salt in the pasta tank, right? But like those little things, you know, despite the constant tasting and the testing of the dishes and making sure that everything's there, that feedback helps you.
I went to Antonucci's, one of my favorite restaurants, his veal tonnato sauce. I was like, I don't know. People have different opinions, but it is different. It's definitely different than the other times I've had here. And he, you know, calls me 2 days later and is like, there was something different. You know, it was another guy that made it. I found out I wasn't there that day. So, you know, interesting stuff.
No, it's true. So
then you can correct it, right? You know that guy made it incorrectly this way, and you know that it's not something that's going to happen. Because you can say,
you
hey,
fire him, and then when you teach the next guy.
Or just like, hey, you forgot to put the salt in.
Yeah.
Or you skip this step.
Yeah, no, for sure. So this week, actors Aaron Paul and Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad announced on Instagram that they teamed up to create their own mezcal brand called Dos Hombres. They wanted to make a real artisanal mezcal made by hand in Mexico. So, you know, speaking of telling people the truth, do you think it's going to be any good?
Dos Hombres.
Do you think that their friends are actually going to tell them if it's good? Or are they going to be like, these guys are famous, it's
Bryan
great.
Cranston.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
I doubt they're going to be in Mexico fermenting the agave. They're probably just paying someone to do it, slapping their label on.
Right, exactly.
Do you think it's going to be a shitty mezcal, or do you think it's going to be an average mezcal, or do you think it's going to be a great mezcal? Does great stars put in their name to
and
a product
and does it matter,
mean anything?
Right?
No, not really. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a trend, right? You have George Clooney did Casamigos, right? Yeah. And then, what's that name? The aviation gin guy. Walter... Wade Goggins. I don't know. One of that.
I know who you're talking about. Another celebrity branded one.
Well, there's a 1802 or whatever is done by the guy from Goodfellas. One of my favorite actors. Who was in Goodfellas?
Joe Pesci.
Ray Liotta.
Ray Liotta does those 1802 tequila ads or 1880, whatever it is.
I think Joe Pesci should start his own.
Aviation is Christian Krogstad and Ryan McGarryan. Is that who you're thinking of?
So it's the other one. It's the guy who's on the Vice Principal show on HBO. He's
in
quite a bit.
I'll Google it in a minute. Yeah. But anyway, I feel like a lot of the newest cocktail programs, you know, but then we have a chef friend, TJ Steele, here in Brooklyn at Claro. He has his own mezcal called El Bujo. But he goes and spends time and he is involved with the community. He sources all of his corn from there. Like, he makes a point to live there for several months of the year and to be involved. And, you know, does a chef's touch make a cocktail program, but, you know, make a product like that better?
Yeah. I think my question, you know, is if you went to our 100 best bartenders who had been on Damon's show, for instance, where would this mezcal rank? And I think the fact they put their names to it means nothing. Like, it will not necessarily. I think it'll be safe and clean and legal. Those things, yes. But then when it comes to the thing, I don't know if they got
it's
the best
bartenders.
It's all
about branding and the label and the people behind it, I think.
Yeah,
but we did,
I have to agree.
We wanted everyone to taste it. We tried to overnight some. It wasn't going
like
to come in time. It wasn't going to come in
we
time for the show.
We almost paid someone to fly with it.
Mezcal in the morning, awesome.
Hey, we got a full bar here in the Heritage Radio studio.
It is sad, though, that famous people put their name to something and it still comes out shitty. I mean, because we looked on the internet yesterday, all these stars are all affiliated with the shittiest foods.
It's all with fast
food. A lot of processed
food.
Yeah,
It's all with junk food, especially with like young, more like teenage popular musicians. Or it's like, I was saying to Patrick, like Peyton Manning is like Progressive Auto Insurance. You know, Charles Barkley and Spike Lee are Capital One Bank. Are people afraid to put their name on something like an individual, you know, cheese that's made by a local dairy?
Jasper
or,
Hill is repped by
or
West
do they
Meryl
not,
Streep.
Or do they not have the money
to
for endorsements?
Probably not as good.
All right, what's a celebrity food pairing you would like to see?
I don't know. If you're good,
I'm thinking
about if Joe Pesci started like a hero shop or something like that.
Joe Pesci hero shop. Love it.
That's a good one. That's a good one. You know, there was our food writer at the Alameda Sun recently did a story about the Donald Trump wall burger. It was just like a totally made-up thing. So we were thinking maybe, you know, Donald Trump could set up a burger stand and start stacking them up down there and build his wall.
You know, Larry King had a bagel company. I think it was short-lived. But he tried to bring bagels out to California.
He couldn't pay back his lenders.
Ha-ha.
Lenders bagels, you won't get that. But now in Australia, by the way, I wanted to, is there an east-west rivalry or a north-south? Like, do people in the north look down on the south as stupid?
Don't they go for people from Queensland out there?
Yeah, well, I'm from Queensland, and we just recently had the State of Origin football, which is a very long-standing rivalry between Queensland and New South Wales, so that's very much a north-south type of rivalry. I think being from Queensland, we probably look down on most of the southern part of Australia because it's just such a fantastic part of the world.
So you're
we're
jealous?
Very, very lucky.
You have the fantastic part
of the world. We live in a great, great part of Australia. So,
do you have different celebrities? Like, are there people that are famous only in the south or only
like,
in the north?
Like, where is Nicole Kidman from? Is she only liked by one half of the continent?
No. I think most of those kind of export celebrities are owned by Australia. In fact, we even adopt some that aren't Australian that people think of as Australian that might come from New Zealand.
Do you consider Olivia Newton-John an export?
Yeah, definitely.
But she lives there.
I think she splits her time.
Okay.
Yeah. I think regionality in celebrities in Australia is probably mainly sports-based. So some sports that are more popular, like Australian rules football versus rugby league football, is very regional.
How is the Crocodile Dundee guy? Is he still out and about?
I think he lives
shows?
In the U.S.
Oh, he lives in the U.S.?
Yeah.
What about that poor nature guy that got killed by the...
Steve Irwin?
Yeah, how is his family running their national park and all that?
Oh,
the zoo?
They're going great guns, and it's been really interesting to see those children grow up in the spotlight and see young Bob, the son, who really is what we'd call a dead ringer for the dad. Like, he looks exactly like Steve, and, you know, to see photos of him feeding the same crocodiles that his father fed, it really gives you goosebumps. Yeah.
Do they have, like, a... Queensland rappers beefing with New South
Wales. Yeah, is that true?
Is there a rap rivalry?
I can't say that I've seen that before, but you know, time will tell.
So speaking of Steve Irwin and, you know, our association with Australia, we typically associate Australia with surfing, the Sydney Opera House, kangaroos, shrimp on the Barbie.
Mad Max.
Sonia told me that when flying here, two TSA agents specifically asked her to please say, throw another shrimp on the Barbie. And wow. She felt obligated to say,
those
she
was people like, should be fired.
So
yeah, yeah.
You told me, you were like, I thought I might end up in quarantine if I didn't agree to
in
do it.
In a small room without windows. very awkward.
So yeah. Did you do it for them?
Maybe.
Yeah, of course you did. Because everyone in Australia is nice. What's your perception on us? I mean, are we dirty, conservative? I mean, are we the same politically as you? I mean, is it like a 50-50-ish split, even though it's really 70-30, most people are Democrats?
Yeah, I'd probably say that we are. Our last couple of elections have been very close. We keep changing prime ministers, which is a bit of a source of national embarrassment, in my opinion. But yeah, I
What's
think we're
term
pretty 50-50
of a,
split.
Of a prime minister? 4 years?
I think so. I'm probably showing my political ignorance
limit?
Here.
Term limit, too?
I believe so, yeah.
Wasn't
yeah.
there a big scandal recently with the prime minister?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, she's from the south, though. You never know.
No, the north.
She's from the north. She's from the north. So, what's the reputation of America? What do you or American chefs, American farmers?
And nimble, agile, smart, giving.
kind, friendly.
Having spent some time in the States now and traveled around, I really notice quite a lot of regionality in terms of the culture and the food and the communities. So. I think it's difficult to stereotype or pigeonhole the entire country. What I would say, though, is I think a lot of... there's a saying in Australian politics that when America sneezes, Australia catches a cold. Oh. Because America often leads the trends in things. And we're seeing that in Australia now with a massive explosion in the popularity of low and slow type cooking and that sort of thing. So... I think we watch America a lot for indicators around food trends. And so that's definitely something that affects the way that we express food in Australia.
I see. Very interesting.
Mm. So before we take a quick break, I want to talk about outdoor dining. How important is it to eat outside? Does it change the whole experience?
I think in New York it's a really nice thing, right? You have like half the year where you don't want to do it, and then you have... the half a year where you just want to be outside.
That sigh was from Patrick.
What if it's on 58th and 3rd? Like, what if you're at the mouth of the Lincoln Tunnel? I don't know. Homeless people clawing at my free bread. Like, hey, man, it's free. You didn't pay for it. Can I have some of it? I don't want dogs peeing on my feet. I don't want to be exhaust fumes, buses, police, muggings, murders, car crash, fender benders. But in certain areas, yes. I love Tribeca. I love Ciccone. Ciccone's is like one of the nicest places to eat in the country. But, you know, most places are just not pleasant, I think, in New York. But
I mean,
you disagree.
58 and 3rd.
I'm with Jeremy. I'm with Jeremy here. I am the New Yorker who is so excited to sit outside. Do I really want like little bits of soot on my plate when I first sit down? No, that's definitely why they've finally learned to like flip over the plate till someone sits down and flip over the cup and all these ridiculous tricks. But there is something very, if it's not muggy, if you're not sweating in your food, and if you're not, you know, if it's too hot, you should not be outside. But to sit on the water at Ciccone's, I mean, that's a whole nother dining experience.
It's also not out. You're kind of under those umbrellas. You do feel like you're in Europe, you know, under those
Pellegrino. Yes, if I can simulate the European outdoor dining experience with the air blowing just right and a little bit of the water, that's perfect.
One time I asked the waiter, this is one of my, I had an experience where I asked the waiter, I was like, what is this sauce? How do you describe it? And they were like, no, a bird just shit on your sauce. Eggs Benedict. And I had eaten half of it. So that's why I was like, no.
So that's where the scars come from. That's so as long as you're covered, you're probably all right.
Yeah, getting hit by all the right. cab when it came in and I have to get my foot amputated because I was sitting outside, that did not bother me. Right. I kept going out.
I was wondering how you got the peg leg.
Oh, my gosh. All right, we have to take a quick break, but stick around. We are going to be back with our weekly grill with Jeremy and Sonia.
This episode is brought to you by Shaxbury Cider, who believe cider can be daring, complex, and eminently drinkable. Located in Vergennes, Vermont, Shaxbury make a broad offering of ciders, from the bright and fruity rosé to inventive small-batch wild apple fermentation. Each fall, Shaxbury takes to the hills of Vermont to forage for the wild and forgotten fruit that make up their Lost Apple Project. Shaxbury, producer of the first American-made Pet Nat cider, continues to experiment every year with limited edition ciders designed to spotlight locally foraged fruit. To learn more, visit shaxbury.com or follow them on Instagram at shaxbury.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I am here in the studio with Jeremy. I just blanked on your last name for a second. Jeremy Price, executive chef of Chaconi's Dumbo, and Sonia Kamisky from Australia. We're going to talk a little bit about heritage beef in a second. So, Jeremy, you recently left Los Angeles. How is the food scene different between New York and L.A.?
I think the food scene in LA is exploding quite a bit because you have so many new restaurants popping up. You have chefs from San Francisco, New York coming in. So you really can sort of get so many different experiences out there. But I also think that, you know, there's more restaurants opening than the clientele can really support. So that'll be an interesting way to see how it goes there. But I also think you find different things in different places, right? In California, I think you don't have the Michelin guide, or up until this year, you didn't have the Michelin guide. So it was a lot more kind of people doing whatever they wanted, whether that be good or bad. Where in New York, I feel like it's a little more structured. You're bound by season a little bit more than New York than you are in LA. So I think at variety in LA, you can get a lot of different things.
Are you liking New York? Is New York's structure, I don't know, stifling?
And I think it's just a lot. It's a lot different in what you can get. Like, you can still get the same variety. I do miss tacos a lot, but, you know, I'll have to go back and get some. No, I love New York, and I love the different cultures that you don't get to access in L.A.
And you said you do not miss the L.A. traffic.
Not one bit.
Not one bit. And tell us, we got to first meet you when you were at the Tasting Kitchen. What did you learn there? Tell us about your mentors.
I think the Tasting Kitchen was a great experience learning about, you know, what we've been talking about the whole day, kind of like using local. You know, we got mostly everything produce-wise from the Santa Monica market. Pigs from Heritage Foods. And really just learning how to treat that ingredient with the most respect. So we would print our menu every single day, so it's always changing, you know, something. If the peaches aren't ripe that day, we don't have peaches on the menu. If someone burns the pig, we don't put the pig on that day. But it's also,
did that happen?
Sad.
No, that's just
is that when we ordered the thing that Cesare got upset about? When we ordered, what was it?
The pork rillettes. Yeah. Like, which was amazing.
Not service time yet.
But no, I mean, it, you really get to learn how to use all the different pieces of the ingredients when they're best.
So who's your mentor?
The chef at the Tasting Kitchen, Casey Lane. I think he instilled a lot of his knowledge, his approach towards ingredients and how to treat them, which he learned in Portland at Clark Lewis. So, you know, just a long string of chefs who've worked everywhere and just kind of sharing that knowledge.
I just got back from the Redwoods in Portland in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, goddamn, that terroir, that region of the world, it's just my favorite. Amount of topsoil, the stone fruit, the cheeses, the beer, just everybody, the people. I fucking love it. Yeah.
Sonia, tell us, what is the state of the heritage breed movement in Australia? And what exactly are you doing there?
So what I'm doing is I work with a very niche premium French breed of cattle called Bazardet, who are hail from southwest France in the Bordeaux region, synonymous with good food and wine. And I'm selling into food service, particularly into French chefs. The French dining experience in Australia is one that I would describe as somewhat inauthentic. I'm not aware of a French restaurant in Australia where you can eat French beef. If you're eating beef in a French restaurant, it's more likely to be Angus or Wagyu beef. Mm. Which I think is really interesting when we're serving French-style wines, French-style cheese, foie gras, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a really big opportunity. in the market. I would describe the heritage breed movement as nascent. It's very new and emerging, and people are sort of pulling back from commodity product and exploring, going deep in some of those niches and appreciation of provenance in a product.
Okay.
An area where we really need to catch up is in the way that we communicate provenance and engage with consumers. And I think one of the challenges as a producer and a brand owner around that, and Jeremy and I were talking about it earlier, is you're in a business-to-business-to-consumer model. So where I work with chefs, how do I also engage with consumers who aren't my direct client, generally speaking, mm-hmm. outside of retail sales? And also with retail sales, is how do we get that distribution model right?
How many heads do you have?
So I am a new brand, so launching later on this year, and we're looking to do about 500 head this year.
How did you get the genetics to Australia originally?
So those genetics have been in the country since the 90s, and they were originally brought in through the live import of cattle out of France. So the product that I work with, we use technology. So all of the cattle are DNA verified so that they're directly related to the same cattle that are in France that are labelled Rouge product in France, which obviously is one of the highest culinary certifications you can have over there. And looking to work with technology partners to start embedding that into blockchain and using distributed ledger technology. So, and again, I was talking to Jeremy earlier about how we engage with consumers. Do we look at things like virtual reality or augmented reality and try and use technology? So, which hopefully will even change the perception of farmers in the community.
And you sell nose to tail? And you're the salesperson?
So, yeah, I'm a very small niche premium, so I know all the customers directly. But the way that we process in Australia is into boxes. So all
you
the
don't
portions,
have to buy the whole animal. You can buy cuts.
Yes, okay. But then that becomes a challenge for me to balance the carcass. So
well, we know.
I have a...
speech into the choir system.
Yeah.
40 country repacks to salt.
I think I'm lucky, though, because our proximity to the Asia Pacific means that I have a market to export cuts that potentially are not as desirable in Australia. So that helps me to spread some of that business risk a little
and
bit.
And cost-wise, that's logistically feasible?
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And now, are other people selling heritage breeds there, like Austral Old Spot pigs? And, I mean, do you see those, like, is the name of the breed written on the menu and all that?
Yeah, that is definitely cool. The trend that's coming out. So in beef, probably the two best-known ones would be, obviously, Wagyu's been a runaway success story in Australia. So in 2012, there were about 3,000 calf registrations in the Australian Wagyu Society, and in 2017, there were about 12,000. So there's been a massive explosion in the popularity and the production of Wagyu beef in Australia.
What's the name of your breed again?
Bazidae.
Bazidae has a certain je ne sais quoi on the
menu.
You
make it sound very nice, yeah. So I market under Epicurean beef, so I can take on all French breeds then. So I really specialise in that type of product.
Very nice. Cool. And this is launching, you said, later this year?
Later this year, summer 2020, yeah.
Fantastic. And will you be doing direct-to-consumer, like mail order, or strictly working wholesale with chefs?
At this stage, I'm working directly with the clients. I think there's still quite a lot of challenge around the cold chain logistics model. I trialled some purchase of cheese in Australia last year, where I spent quite a lot of money ordering imported cheese, and that cheese arrived and it was actually hot. Because they just simply couldn't keep it cold. The country's too big. The logistics model's not mature enough. So the jury's still out. And I've visited brands here in the States, and those producer-led brands are reporting that less than 1% of their revenue comes from their online business. So it seems like it's still a model with a lot of potential, but just not really getting any traction at this stage.
Cool. Well, that's really exciting. Yep. Thanks for coming by the studio and sharing with us
me.
To both of you. Jeremy, we always love eating your food, and it's a pleasure to have you here in New York.
It's happy to be here.
Yeah. And welcome to today's going to be a muggy, humid New York summer day for you.
Yeah, all my days off recently have just been super rainy.
All right.
But I'm just happy to have some sunshine.
All right. Sounds good.
And stay tuned. Next week, we have a big show. We're going to have Donald Trump, George Bush, Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter talking about their food trends at the White House, although that's not confirmed.
Not confirmed yet.
I bet you'll
stay tuned. Make sure to listen in. Thanks so much. And don't forget to visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate for the 10th anniversary summer drive. There are new member gifts associated with your new memberships. Stick around for Life's a Banquet, I believe, is up next. Have a good one. See you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.